Well, it's great to see you today. A few people have been asking me about the shoebox ministry that we usually do on Christmas, so I just thought I would explain it to you. For a couple years, I've been uncomfortable taking those presents down and smuggling them across the border. And so we've been asking for a couple years if they would find out how to do the paperwork legally so we could do it. I didn't want to jeopardize our people or our witness and, you know, doing that. And it just never came about. So we're looking for alternatives, and we're making some plans to do an outreach to an orphanage down in Tijuana, probably in February or March or something like that. And we're doing our backpack ministry for the homeless. As you know, next Sunday is the day for that. So I loved doing it, but it's one of those things where when you're doing God's work and you don't want to just be thinking, we'll just slide this by and not worry about it, because I want God to bless everything that we do because we're really trying to do it right. And so that's what happened with that. And it will, you know, maybe next year we'll do Samaritan's Purse or something, but by the time we knew this wasn't going to come together, it was too late to do anything else. So that's that. Now let's turn in our Bibles to the book of 1 Kings. As we are going through the Bible in a year, we move rapidly through each book, and today we've come to the book of 1 Kings, which, as I've mentioned before, is actually a half of a book, because 1 and 2 Kings was the book of the kings originally, and then it was cut into two. The reason it's called Kings is there are a whole lot of kings that are talked about in these two books. And when 1 Kings starts up, David is king still. And it shows the end of his life, his son Solomon taking over, which altogether that meant three kings total that ruled over all of Israel: Saul, David, and Solomon. But then what happens, and the book of 1 Kings gets us started on this pathway, we realize that the nation split, as is very typical, and, you know, trying to get people to work together and everything. The nation split into two kingdoms. The northern kingdom, which is then called Israel because it's 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel, and then the southern kingdom, which is generally called Judah, because Judah is one of the tribes, is the predominant tribe in the south, along with the little tribe of Benjamin. So when Solomon died, you have the division of the north and south. The north ends up going into captivity later, as we will see, to the Assyrians, and the south, Judah, will end up going into captivity to the Babylonians. But we witness in this book that split, see a lot of the reasons for it, and then see kind of what happens. And the overall lesson of the book, to a great extent, I think, is when leaders do well, people are blessed. And when leaders become bad, then people end up becoming bad themselves and suffering. It's one of the things that we see when we look at the world today, that we think if we remove a bad leader, somehow things are going to turn around. But very often people who have been so conditioned by bad leaders will just put another bad leader in charge. We see this laid out. People who follow God and are faithful to him are really blessed. People who don't, they end up having real problems. And that becomes the lesson through 1 and 2 Kings. And then when we get to the books of Chronicles, it's kind of a repeat of what we've read in Samuel and Kings, but now it just emphasizes the kings in Judah, and it pretty much ignores the kings in the northern tribes. About the only good kings were the ones that were in Judah, and only some of those were good. But Chronicles is going to be a rerun, and so some of the things that we kind of skip over fast in the books of Kings will go into more detail when we get to Chronicles. But let me walk you through the book of 1 Kings so you can get a feel of the land. It starts out with David still as king, but he's old and getting senile. And David finishes poorly. We often talk about finishing well. You just want to, you know, do what you do and make sure that you end well. So often people don't. And David, as we saw last week, was a guy who things seemed to deteriorate for him as he got older. Here in 1 Kings, you just see kind of a disgraceful end to his life. Then later we're going to see Solomon has the same sort of thing happen. Remember, we talked last week about David, how he was amazingly gracious to others. There were several people that we thought, man, I would have killed that guy, and he didn't. Like Joab, the general who killed Abner. Like Shimei, the guy who was yelling and cursing David and trash-talking him when he got kicked out of Jerusalem when Absalom came in. And then when they came back, Shimei's there, and everybody's going, kill Shimei, man. Remember what that guy said about you. And David said, no, you know, this is a day of celebration. He goes, I'm not going to kill him. And he said, Shimei, you're safe as long as I'm alive, which is a really nice thing. And you go, wow, that's pretty cool of David to do that when this guy had said all these bad things about him. Well, as he gets old, then he starts thinking twice. And he had said that, yeah, Shimei, you're going to be alive as long as I am. But then he starts telling Solomon, you know, I told Shimei that he'd live as long as I'm alive, he's safe. But when I die, I want you to kill him. And by the way, Joab's getting on my nerves too. Kill him too. So we see in the first few chapters, David gives a to-do list to Solomon that's basically kill these people. And that's not the greatest way to go, certainly, and kind of embarrassing. Maybe the people needed to die, maybe they didn't. But it just is a kind of a sad way for your life to end. For the discussion questions for the Home Fellowship, I didn't do this, but I was going to have the first question be, if you were going to die and leave orders to kill several people after your death, who would you? But I ended up not doing it. In fact, I haven't written the discussion questions yet. I'll have to do those this afternoon. But so you see that, and now Solomon becomes king. Solomon does everything David said, and then he's like, what do I do now? But God comes to Solomon in a real stunning thing, and God said, you know, I loved your dad so much that I'm going to ask you, and I will grant your one wish. Whatever you want, I'll give it to you. What do you want? As a tribute to your dad. And his dad, David, had always told him, in everything that you try to get wisdom. If anyone ever asks you what you want, desire wisdom, because wisdom is the primary thing. It's the best thing. The capacity to evaluate situations, make creative decisions, make good decisions that have good results, wisdom. Go for that. So when God comes and says, okay, what do you want? He says, God, I want wisdom. And we see no sign in Solomon before this of him being particularly bright or creative. But God said to him, boy, was that a good answer. And since you ask for the best thing, which is wisdom, I'm also going to give you the things that you didn't ask for, the riches that most people would ask for, power and influence that most people might have thought of. But you came up with the best thing, and so I'm going to give you these other things as well. Which, when you think about it, if you have wisdom, all those other things will end up coming to you anyway. If you make good decisions, you'll always find a way to be wealthy. You'll always find a way to be successful at what you do. You'll always have a lot of friends. You'll always have influence. And so, but God just told them, hey, that's the way it's going to work. And God said, I'm going to make you wiser than anyone who has ever lived, and wiser than anyone who will ever come after you. Of course, Jesus would be the exception because he was around before and hadn't lived on the earth as a man yet. But other than Jesus, Solomon, I believe, was the wisest man ever, according to what God says. And we can learn a lot from Solomon because we know he had this kind of wisdom. And as we begin to read through in 1 Kings, we see how he wrote thousands of proverbs and songs. And he accomplished great things. One of the greatest things he did was construct the greatest building complex ever, the Temple of Israel, there in Jerusalem, this amazing temple. And he put that all together, conceived of it, developed it, and made it, and it was impressive. But he also became great militarily. And in every way, his wealth was just unbelievable. The Queen of Sheba came just to see, wow, this is impressive. This is amazing. We saw his wisdom manifested right away after God gave him the wisdom over in chapter 3 when there's two ladies who, prostitutes, who each had babies, and one of them rolled over in her sleep and suffocated her baby. And so then she grabbed the other baby. She swapped the babies. So they came to the king to say, we need a DNA test. Whose baby is the living baby? They both say that it's theirs. And Solomon came up with this brilliant idea. He said, okay, well, just cut the baby in half and give half to each mom. And the mom who wasn't really the mother said, yeah, sounds good to me. The mom who was the real mother said, no, give the baby to her. I don't want the baby to die. And so then obviously they knew who the real mother was. But we see this happening with Solomon. We read the book of Proverbs today, and most of them are written by Solomon and have incredible insight into life. I try to read at least a chapter of Proverbs every day because I learn more from that book than I do from almost any other advice that I could ever get. So Solomon's an amazing guy, but we see as you get to chapter 11, he went bad. Because he was wise, he was attractive. Because he was attractive, he had a lot of women, married 700 women, had 300 concubines on the side, and that wasn't smart. He went against his wisdom. He went against God had told him. And then most of those women had other religions, and that corrupted him. And it ended up at the end, his end was tragic because he had just given up on God, and he was being torn by all these women. And so we see that happen. Now, when he dies, his son, Rehoboam, is appointed to be the king. And so you think, okay, he's inheriting a great job, which he was. But prior to Solomon's death, there was a guy named Jeroboam who a prophet had come forward and said, the nation is going to be divided and you're going to be the king over 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, that wasn't, he was like, oh, great. And then he ran and lived in Egypt because, you know, that wouldn't be a popular thing to have hanging over your head that you're the heir apparent when the king has a son. But when Rehoboam became king, Jeroboam ended up moving back because it's like, okay, great, no pressure on me, Rehoboam's king. But people saw Jeroboam as a great leader, which he was. He had been a great soldier for Solomon prior to that. So anyway, as Rehoboam became king, the people were talking and they were like, we have a new leader. I hope he lightens up a little bit. Maybe he'll cut taxes. Because in order for Solomon to do everything he did, it cost a lot of money. And so the people were just being stretched to their limits by paying all the taxes that they were paying. And Solomon, as he became older, really ruled with an iron fist as well. So they came, the people said, let's go ask Rehoboam if he'll give us a break. And if he'll be nicer than his dad, great. So they elected Jeroboam as the spokesman because he was well respected. And Jeroboam with some other guys came to Rehoboam and said, we're glad you're king. Congratulations. Your dad was getting pretty mean. He was hard on people and the taxes were killing us. So do you think that you could lighten up a little bit as it's a new administration? And could you give us a break? And if you do, people are going to love you. You're going to be really popular. So he said, well, I'll think about it. So he called in the advisors who were his dad's advisors. Obviously, if you were an advisor to Solomon, you were pretty smart. And he goes, what do you think? This is what the people are saying. And the advisors go, that's a great idea. You need something to have you seen as being a leader that in some way the people are going to benefit even more. So, yeah, it's a great idea. However, then he asked a bunch of his young buddies, what do you guys think? And they go, are you kidding? They're going to think you're a wimp if you do that. You need to rule harder than your dad. You need to tell people, hey, you think my dad was tough. Wait till you try to mess with me. And so he took that advice, calls Jeroboam and tells him that, and the people are just crushed. It did exactly what the advisor said it would do. And most of the tribes of Israel, especially those 10 tribes in the north that are far away from the central government, feel like it's like the way the Americans felt when they were under British rule. Hey, taxation without representation is tyranny. Why should we give all of our stuff so that you can build a fancier place down in Jerusalem? And they split, and the 10 tribes asked Jeroboam to be their king. And this is where the kingdoms were split. 10 tribes in the north that will hereafter be called Israel. When it says Israel, it's talking about the northern tribes, because that is most of Israel. The southern tribes, which were Judah, which was the predominant one, and Benjamin, which is a little tiny one that hung with Judah, they're called Judah. Now, remember, that's where Jerusalem is. Jerusalem is in the tribe of Judah. And so the temple and worship and everything is down there. So now, for the first time, you have a nation that's completely divided. You saw some of the signs of it earlier, because the northern tribes tended to side more with Saul when David was coming into leadership. David was really loved in Judah. But now it's split for good, and never again would this be resolved. So as you go through the rest of the book of 1 Kings, you see a succession of kings. And it really covers, from when the kingdom split, it covers an 86-year time period. Now, during that 86 years, the southern kingdom, Jerusalem, had four kings. Two of them, you know, Rehoboam and Adonijah, were kind of bad kings. Then Asa came along in Judah, and he was an awesome king and was a king for like 44 years. And then Jehoshaphat after him was also a good king. So four kings in 86 years, too bad, too good. In the north, you started out with Jeroboam, and he went bad. But altogether, during that 86 years, there were eight kings in the north. A bunch of guys that you don't hear much about, Omri, Zimri, and all these guys. They're some of them rule for as many as 22 to 24 years. Zimri, I think, was in office for 1 week. It varied. But the kings in the north, the kings of Israel, had one thing in common. They were all bad. They were just all complete dirtbags. And it seemed like they got worse as it went along. And when we get to 2 Kings, we'll see some that are even more evil than Ahab, who was the most evil one in the book of 1 Kings. Now, during the time of Ahab, who was one of the evil northern rulers who was married to a girl named Jezebel, the prophet Elijah comes on the scene. More time is spent on Ahab than on the other kings, not because Ahab was significant, but primarily because Elijah, the greatest prophet in the history of Israel, was there during the time of Ahab. So that's takes you through the book of 1 Kings. Now, as I look at it and I go, okay, what should we emphasize? I thought first, clearly the idea that bad leaders make bad people. And we see that, but we're going to see it through the rest of the books as well. I also thought of the theme of finishing poorly, because David and then Solomon after him both ended their lives pretty bad. But after I looked through this and reflected on it some more, two things jumped out at me that seemed to be almost unrelated, but I think they're very related when you consider them. And the two events that I want to just focus on a little bit with you this morning are, first of all, the building of the temple, which is the most amazing accomplishment that there is. And I think there are a lot of lessons there. But the temple is an example of a brilliant guy with a great plan, with a lot of cooperation, and the best building materials imaginable, creating a house that's so beautiful that God says, as long as you keep your heart with me, I will live there. That says what it is that I want you to do. That's the epitome of an accomplishment of an incredibly creative, incredibly wise man. And a lot of people are involved in it. And so what I see in that whole section is when a plan really comes together. It's a beautiful thing when you have a plan and it just works almost perfectly, and amazing results take place. And so we're going to look at that. But the second thing is the prophet Elijah and his ministry. Because Elijah is a guy who, amazingly godly, greatest of the Hebrew prophets. Elijah is the one who will come back and testify during the tribulation period in the future before the Lord returns, according to the book of Malachi. Elijah was also the one who, he and Moses showed up on the Mount of Transfiguration, got to meet Jesus personally. So Elijah's an amazing guy. Now, didn't write any books or anything, but an amazing figure in the history of Israel. And he had great plans and good things happened, but ultimately, for Elijah, things didn't work out the way he wanted them to. He was very disappointed because there was a great plan, a great opportunity, powerful things happening, and it just like fell flat for him. And he became very discouraged and actually wanted to die after his greatest victory. And so these two bookends of the book of 1 Kings, in a way, are two things that I see. Number one, when a plan really comes together, how great is that? And number two, how do you handle it when the plan doesn't come together the way that you want it to? So first, let's look, beginning with verse 5, at this whole temple. The way the whole deal started, you know, God had told David wanted to build a temple for God, and God said, nope, you know, your hands are bloody, you're not the guy that ought to be doing this. But I'm going to give you a son, and he's going to reign on the throne, and he will build the house for me. So Solomon knew that this was his commission. Now, by this time, he had got his incredible wisdom, and he was showing it in so many different ways, and he was successful beyond his imaginations. And it hit him, man, I wonder when the temple happens. Well, a king named Hiram, who was the king of Tyre, and Tyre and Sidon are two little cities, port cities, at the northern end of Israel on the Mediterranean Sea. They're up at present-day Lebanon today. And these areas were renowned for their wood, for their logging industry and the beautiful wood that they would build things out of. You've heard of the cedars of Lebanon. Those were in this area. Well, this King Hiram had been a good friend to David's. So in chapter 5, he sends word to Solomon and he goes, hey, I'm sorry about your dad. And, you know, he was a great man, but congratulations to you. If there's anything I can do, I want to be friends with you. I want to be partners with you. And so this invitation comes, and Solomon, in his wisdom, realizes this is an opportunity that we were really looking for. And so he goes back to Hiram, and he says in verse 5 of chapter 5, behold, I propose to build a house for the name of Yahweh my God, the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke to my father David. So, verse 6, therefore command that they, your people, cut down cedars for me from Lebanon, and my servants will be with your servants, and I will pay you wages for your servants according to whatever you say, for you know there is none among us who has skill to cut timber like the Sidonians. So he says, you guys are the best when it comes to woodwork. And so I want your guys to work with our guys, and we'll pay you for it. And we need a bunch of wood because I'm building a house for God, as my dad told me to. And so Hiram said, hey, great. Whatever you want, we'll do it. As you read down in chapter 5 further, in verse 13, Solomon raised up a labor force out of all Israel, and the labor force was 30,000 men. Now, this wasn't just 30,000 people to work on the temple. This was 30,000 guys to learn how to do woodworking, to just do the wood part. And so in the next verse, it says that he sent them down there 10,000 a month. So you'd spend, a third of the guys would spend a month up there in Lebanon training and learning how to do wood and helping cut the wood. And then the other two-thirds would be doing work back at home, and they would rotate 10,000 people at a time going up to Lebanon to cut wood and to train, and the other guys back at home actually doing the work. Quite a workforce. And it goes on, and he says he had 70,000 who just carried the wood and other stuff, and 80,000 who quarried stone in the mountains. This wasn't just going to be a wood house. It was going to be built of these massive stones that would be quarried out of a rock cliff. And the stones of the temple, if you've never been over there to see them, are like as big as a bus. And they would be carved so intricately and so neatly that they would fit perfectly in place, not using any kind of grout or anything between the joints. They had to be done well. So he has all these people doing rock work, and 3,300 people who were just supervising the work, and The king commanded them in verse 17, quarry large stones, costly stones, hewn stones to lay the foundation of the temple. Now we see the design and layout of the temple in chapter 6, and it was 60 cubits long, which a cubit is about 18 inches, so think, 90 feet long, and it was 30 feet wide, 20 cubits, and it was 45 feet high. This is a big temple, and that's just the temple proper. There were all kinds of buildings around it that were attached to it. So this massive thing, and they were, and in verse 7 it says it was built with stone finished at the quarry so that no hammer or chisel or any iron tool was heard in the temple while it was being built. Imagine building something where all the parts have to be perfect off-site and then quietly slid into place. And in verse 9 it says he paneled the temple with beams and boards of cedar. And God came to him in verses 11 and 12 and said, hey, this temple that you're building, if you walk in my statutes and execute my judgments and keep all my commandments and walk in them, then I'll perform my word with you, which I spoke to your father David. God basically is saying, I like what you're doing, and as long as your heart's right, I'm gonna be there in a special way. Talks about the inside of the walls being cedar, and the floor of the temple in verse 15 is covered with cypress planks. And you see the inside of the temple was cedar, verse 18, carved with ornamental buds and open flowers, and it was all cedar. And the inner sanctuary was overlaid, after it was carved up, it was overlaid with pure gold, and the altar was made out of cedar but overlaid with gold. The inside of everything was pure gold, gold chains all around. In verse 23, the inner sanctuary, he made two cherubim of olive wood, each 15 feet high and 15 feet at their wingspan. And the two of them were in the Holy of Holies, wings touching in the middle, wings touching the walls. This place was amazing. And as you read, everything was carved out of wood and then coated with gold. And you see, like down in verse 29, these carved cherubim and palm trees and open flowers were all parts of the walls of the temple. And the two doors in verse 32 were made of olive wood, and he carved them figures of cherubim, palm trees, open flowers, and overlaid them with gold. And verse 34, the two doors were made of cypress, and he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers on them and overlaid them with gold. As you read through chapter 7 as well, you see the intricate designs. There were these massive bronze pillars for the temple with fancy things on the top of them. And then they made these carts, and the carts were made of paneled wood with fancy carvings on them and bronze wheels. They used so much bronze that they couldn't even weigh it all, he said. And then the furnishings for the temple, everything was designed for the lavers and the altars and all that kind of stuff, the candlesticks and the places for the showbread. And when you read it, you just go, wow, this is pretty fancy. And you wonder, why did they make it so detailed? Especially, why go to the trouble of making all these hand carvings and then lay gold over the top of it where no one will see the wood? It seems unnecessary. You could have just cast the gold or the bronze or whatever and you had plywood on the back. And you look at it and go, and why the pomegranates and the cherubim and the flowers and the palm trees and what's all that about? I look at it that way because for me, I don't always value fancy. I don't always value intricate. To me, it'd be like, if we didn't have this place, we could meet at the park. No big deal. Just pitch a tent. And God, there's a part of God that is that way because he said, I don't dwell in a house. Don't think that you can restrict me to this little box. And yet, we can't escape the fact that this was the product of a man who God attested that he is the wisest man ever. And God said, in the middle of it and at the end of it, I like it. I'm going to live there. I appreciate that. And so it causes me to think, why? I mean, God has can make things just by saying it. Why did he appreciate thousands and thousands of people working together to make this beautiful house? And, you know, one thing is, as close to the nature of God as you can get is as close as you can get to creativity. God appreciates detail and creativity. And historically, Christians understood this. It's why so many of the great works of art and the great pieces of music were written for God, were dedicated to him. Because when you look at his creation, you realize God likes things to be nice and fancy and intricate. You know, you look at stars that he created that are so beautiful that we'll never see. You look at a flower, and it's beautiful on the surface, but you begin to zoom in with a microscope and then to understand the symmetry and the development that is involved in that thing. Why? Why does he make them all different colors? Why are there mathematical equations that are common through nature? What is all this about? Because when God creates, he does it really fancy. He does it really well. And he appreciates that kind of an effort. And I think it's good for us to think about that when we do stuff for God. And by the way, everything that we do, we're supposed to do it for God. So how much attention do we give to detail? Or do we just gloss it over and veneer everything and make it so that, like, yeah, if you squint, it looks okay. It'll be all right. A lot of you know I really appreciate Apple computer products. Now, I know some of you don't, and this isn't a commercial for Apple. Apple doesn't need me to endorse them. People just look at their products and know that they want them. And some of you may just go, I just like my computer to be a metal box with screws falling out of it, and it sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, and I'm fine with that. You know, but Steve Jobs, the creator of Apple computers, has this philosophy, had it, he just recently passed away, but he had this philosophy that he wanted things to be perfect even if people couldn't see it. And so if you open an Apple computer, the circuit board is beautiful, the arrangement of the chips are well thought out. Engineers went nuts working for Jobs because he would say, here's how I want it to be, now you figure out a way to make that work. And the first Apple computer was sealed up. You couldn't open it. Needed a special screwdriver to open it up. So naturally, I got one of those screwdrivers, and I opened it up. And I couldn't believe it. Inside this sealed box, everything was gorgeous. And in fact, he had all of the original members of the Macintosh team sign their signatures inside the case of the Macintosh that no one would ever see. And he explained recently why he did that, and he said his dad was a carpenter, among other things, and he said when his dad made a fence, he told Steve, I want the back of the fence to look as good as the front of the fence. And he goes, why, Dad? Nobody will ever see the back of the fence. And he said, but you will, and you'll know what it looks like, and you need to put your best effort in. He said when his dad made a chest of drawers, he would never use plywood on the back of the thing. And he goes, Dad, nobody's going to see it. He goes, doesn't matter. You'll see it. You'll know. Maybe somebody will see it. And when they see the back of that cabinet, they will know how much effort you put into creating it, how much you really love that design. And so as a result, you see a series of Apple products, and some of them have not been so well, but most of them become the model for everyone else to make cheap copies of. For everyone else to just make cheesy imitations. And if you look at the real product and you use it, and you look at one of the cheesy copies, you just realize this works, but it's not quite the same. Now, if somebody would do that for electronic products, if somebody would be that intricate, what should we do when we're doing something for God? How should we approach those things that we do as an expression to him of our devotion to him, which is what everything that we do should do? And I would propose to you that the Temple of Solomon stands out as an example of how something like this should happen. A great plan that comes together in an amazing way. Now, when there's a great plan, there needs to be creativity, there needs to be attention to detail, but it's also always teamwork. It takes a lot of people working together to make this happen. And on your best day, when you do your best work and you take care of attention to details, sometimes it turns out like the temple. Like, wow. People came from all over the world to just stare at that temple. And for all the rest of time, people look back. That was what you call a building. That was amazing. And so God goes into great details for the plans and everything, as he does when he describes heaven, by the way, in the same sort of ways, because God cares about the details and he cares about things being beautiful. And he doesn't mind sometimes going overboard and putting too much time and too much effort and too much money sometimes into making something look nice so that people can go, wow, that's really cool. Now, in our lives, sometimes we will participate in projects that feel that way. That everybody there is on board and everybody's working together and everyone's doing their best work and you look for the details. And so there are some people that want to do it over and over again until they get it just right. And it's such a pleasure when that happens in whatever way, whether it's in a ministry or a building or in what you do at your work or things that you do together with your family or the way you decorate your home or whatever. I hope that you get an experience of going, I had part in something that really does reflect the beauty, the sense of aesthetic, the creativity, and the details that our God puts into things that he does. To do something well, whether it's winning an athletic event, whether it's painting a picture, whether it's raising a child, whatever it is that we do, to get together and do something awesome is a wonderful thing. However, as we come to the story over in chapter 17, beginning in chapter 17, of Elijah, sometimes this is our experience. Elijah was the best prophet ever. He was amazing. He not only made it not rain until he said so, he called fire from heaven. Awesome prophet. And yet, at the time, there was a great king in Judah, and there was a terrible king in Israel. So guess where he had to work? The greatest prophet in the history of God's people had to work in the north under an evil king, Ahab, with his wife Jezebel. Now, this seems like a waste. And sometimes you get to think, I just must be in the wrong position because I'm going in one direction and it seems like I'm so countercultural and counterintuitive. I must be in the wrong place. And yet God had put him there. Now, as you read through the story, you remember it. I mean, he said to stop raining, and it did. God took care of him miraculously during the drought. Finally, Ahab hears that it's his fault that it's not raining. He goes and confronts him, and he goes, "You're troubling Israel." And he goes, Elijah goes, "No, you're troubling Israel. This is your fault." And he said, "It's time to throw down on this thing, and let's find out who the real God is." So he said, "Gather all of Israel." You see at the end of chapter 18, "Now therefore send and gather all Israel to me on Mount Carmel, 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." These are your wives' prophets. "And get them together and we're going to find out right now who the real God is." What a cool plan. And the plan was, we're going to see who can bring fire from heaven. He didn't tell them that was the plan necessarily ahead of time, or they would have brought flint and stuff. So it's just like, show up and let's see what happens. And he goes, "Okay, here's the deal. Whoever the real God is, make a sacrifice and have it burn up with no flint and no matches. Just bring fire from heaven." And the prophets of Baal are like, "We have to go first?" Yeah. And so all day long, they're dancing, chanting, doing all their magic, cutting themselves. The whole time, there's no fire from heaven. The whole time, Elijah's trash-talking them, going, "Hey, what's the matter? Maybe do it a little louder. Maybe Baal can't hear you. Or maybe he's in the bathroom. Yell a little bit louder, and maybe he'll show up. Maybe he's on vacation." And so he's doing all this, no fire. And then he builds the altar. And I don't know if he's stalling for time or whatever, but he pours water all over it, all around it, soaks it. I think he figures either fire's going to come from heaven or I'm going to look stupid. And so he does this, and then he prays to God, and he goes, "God, you see what I got going here. It would be really cool if you just bring fire from heaven right now so that people could know that you're the real God. And poof, fire came from heaven and burned the sacrifice, turned all the water into steam, burned the rocks, burned the dirt, just absolutely devastated the top of Mount Carmel. And the people, I love this. It's like, this is what Elijah has been dreaming of his whole life. Verse 39 of chapter 18. Now, when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." And he goes, "While you're fired up, go kill the prophets of Baal." And they did. And then the drought ends and it rains. Now, this is a perfect plan coming together perfectly until chapter 19, when Jezebel heard what had happened and she sent a message in verse 2 and 3. Well, in verse 2, she sent a message to Elijah saying, "So let the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." And when he saw that, he arose and ran for his life. He went out in the wilderness, sat under a broom tree in verse 4, and he prayed that he might die and said, "It is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's." What happened? God had done an amazing thing, but Elijah thought that when fire came from heaven and the prophets of Baal were killed, he assumed those people that said, "The Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God," now they're going to turn to God. But Jezebel's still on the throne, and the people are still allowing her to be, and she has messengers, and she's making threats, and it's become obvious. This is no revival. I thought it was. I thought we were onto something, and I went out on a limb, and we went to all this trouble, and nothing. It's just a complete waste. And now he's totally depressed because the plan didn't go exactly the way he thought it should or wanted to. And how sad that he could flip so quickly. And we can look at this, but the truth is we're all subject to that kind of thing where God does a lot, but then he doesn't quite do everything we want him to do. And then we're just, "I give up. There's no reason to live." And so, as he lay there under the broom tree, in verse 5, an angel came and touched him and said to him, "Get up and eat." And so he looked, and there was cake that was baked in a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came back, verse 7, the second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you." So he arose and ate and drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, the Mount of God, or Mount Sinai, where the law was originally given. So God comes to him and he goes, "You know what? You're tired and you're hungry. So rest, eat, and drink." He does that and goes back to sleep. God lets him rest. Then he goes, "Okay, you need to eat because there's stuff you need to do. The journey is too great for you if you don't take care of yourself." And so he goes and journeys 40 days and 40 nights and goes to Mount Sinai and goes in a cave. And he says to the Lord, "I'm fed up." God shows up and says, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And verse 10, Elijah had prepared this speech. "I've been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forgotten your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." He was pretty bummed. The plan wasn't going the way he thought it would. But God said to him, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord." And it says the Lord passed by. And a great and strong wind tore into the mountains and broke the rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a whisper, a still small voice. Elijah came out when he heard it, and he wrapped his face in his mantle, and the voice whispered, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He gave his little speech again, and then in verse 15, the Lord said to him, "Go return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria. Also you shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel, and Elisha, you'll anoint as prophet in your place. And it shall be that whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill. Whoever escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha will kill. Yet, verse 18, I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. So then Elijah went down and found Elisha and took him on as his assistant and ultimately began to groom him to take over. Interesting. You know, when God shows up, you kind of expect it to be in a big, booming way, like the wind hitting and blowing rocks around, like a tornado, or an earthquake that shakes the mountain, or fire that comes down. I mean, fire had been where God was the first time on Mount Carmel. Now he's on Mount Sinai. He's like, where's God? And there's fire and no God. But it turns out, after all of that, God just wanted to whisper to him. And a lot of times, God wants to whisper to us. And we can't hear him because we're expecting him to scream at us. We're expecting him to do big, spectacular things. And all along, he's whispering. But we have to get past all the noise so that we can actually hear what he has to say when he whispers. A good teacher never tries to raise their voice to get over the kids because the numbers are against you and you just can't do it. You get louder, kids get louder. A good teacher knows how to begin to whisper and the kids shut up and begin to, what she said, what? You know, and that's what God does sometimes. Bunch of noise, nothing. A whisper, there's God. And God just listened to him. So far, God has given him a rest, given him some exercise, given him some food. And now he says to him, you're not alone. You know, let's be realistic. I still have work for you to do. In fact, you're going to go down and anoint a Syrian guy to be king over Syria. And Syria is going to attack Israel. And I'm going to use them to judge Israel. But I also have a king that you're going to anoint in the north. And he's not going to be a great guy, but you're going to anoint him, which means Ahab and Jezebel are about to be gone. And then he says, but besides that, I have a guy who's going to stand beside you and work with you going into the future. And then ultimately, the truth is, as he says, I have reserved 7,000 in Israel whose knees haven't bowed to Baal. You're not as alone as you think you are. There are more people behind what we're doing than you realize. The devil had lied to him and made him feel like he was alone. God came to him and just gently whispered to him, you're not alone. And this isn't over yet. My plan hasn't been completed yet. But if Elijah could see that his plan ends in the streets of Jerusalem in the tribulation period as he declares the gospel to people, would it be a big deal what Jezebel thought? Jezebel was about to be thrown out of a tower and eaten by dogs. So really, that's who you're worried about? That's what you're worried about? For us, sometimes the plan comes together perfectly. And I hope that you've all had the privilege of working together with others in a way that just really comes together. In a way that's just like, wow, I'm blessed, I'm fortunate to be involved in that project. I saw what God was doing and it was awesome. Every day we saw God's hand on us. Every time we began to do something, it just fell together. Miracles happened everywhere. And I love that. And again, that kind of creative, detailed devotion to intricate, you know, beauty is something that we should all shoot for. If our plans aren't to do it that way, then no surprise that what we do ends up being cheesy. Because we're trying for cheesy. If you try for cheesy, you usually get even worse than cheesy. Because you end up surrounded by a bunch of people who settle for cheesy. And that's all they want. But we should always shoot for the temple. We should always shoot for that kind of, I want to do things so well that people's minds will be blown when they see it and it'll be a testimony of God. But sometimes we're going to do that to the best of our ability and it doesn't always come together the way we think it will. Ultimately, it always comes together in the end. But in the middle of the process, sometimes we're going to find ourselves like Elijah, feeling like, "What? Why am I alive? Why did I spend so much work and energy for years seeing miracles happen, calling fire from heaven, finally, I knew what was going to happen. The people were going to turn to God, and they did, and then they go, ah, never mind. This stinks, and this feels awful, and you feel like, what in the world am I working for? What am I laboring for? But God comes along and whispers to him and to us, I'm not through yet. What are you feeling frustrated about? What are you feeling defeated in? What do you feel like your plans have just crashed and burned? God is coming to you and he wants to whisper to you, you're not alone. I'm not done. Great things are going to happen. They're about to happen. But it's not all you. It can't just all be about you. It's going to be because a lot of people get involved and are supportive and have the same kind of standards for excellence and desire to see this happen. And that's God's word to us. Maybe for you, all you ever wanted was to have the perfect family. And so you did everything you could do to have a great marriage and great kids and a great house and a good dog. And, oh, you know, it was just like you had this Solomon Temple kind of image of what your life was going to be. And you did everything that you could to try to make that happen. And in the end, maybe it didn't happen. Maybe your kids don't like you, your dog bit you, your wife leaves you, your house is foreclosed on, and you're thinking, oh man, what am I even living for? I gave the best years of my life to build a family and a household, and now they all hate me. Why did I even do this? Maybe that was your career. Maybe you put all of your efforts into what you do for a living. Maybe you started a business, or maybe you just worked in another business, and you were like Solomon. You're like, everything needs to be done right. I'm very meticulous. I'm honest to the extreme. I'm the hardest working person there, and I'm doing it as unto the Lord, and then I just lose my job. The industry goes under. Things go bad, and I think, why did I even do that? Why was I loyal to that? Why was that important to me? You know, maybe you've been involved in a church and felt like this is my life, and you do your best, and it just flops. It doesn't go. It doesn't happen, or it turns on you, or things happen, and you just feel like, oh, man, what am I doing? Maybe you have friendships that you would have done anything for that person, and you often did, and then, boom, what happened? I don't know. They found another friend. And it's gone, and you think, what's the point? Maybe you've had a relationship that went bad, and you go, I'm never going to love again after that. But what God is whispering to us is, you do everything as unto me, and I'm not done with you. I'm not finished yet. I'm just getting started. And the truth is, you just need to be linked up with the right people, people getting together. You need to set higher standards. You need to try to do your absolute best at what you do. And this thing is going to finish off amazing. And I love it when I see things come together, especially after it seems like it's not. But I would like my whole life to be lived in the temple construction. It's great. Whenever we have work days at the church, I just love it. Or, you know, Saturday, decorating the church. And while it was being decorated for Christmas, the guys were putting together the nursing mother's room back there. I look in there and I want to cry. It's just so beautiful and such a nice, peaceful place for ladies to sit with their babies. And I just think, this is awesome. It's just the details, and it's just perfect. And that's the way I'd like my life to be all the time. But, you know, sometimes it just doesn't go that way. And even when you do, like, I look at the church, I go, man, it looks great. It's simple. It's beautiful. It reminds us of Christmas. But I know there are going to be people who go, what? Why didn't you get a bigger tree? There's no angels on top of the tree. It's not a tree without an angel. There's no, you know, well, you should have done this. You should have done that. Well, hey, you weren't here. And, you know, but that's a way you can look at life. You can always pick things apart. And the trouble is, a lot of people are going to do that. But the people who care about doing things well are always going to enjoy working together and doing their best and doing it as unto the Lord. But for you, wherever you find yourself, maybe you've just been having temple experiences. Awesome. It's great for you. Maybe, though, you're like Elijah and you're curled up in a heap in the mountain and you're just going, I don't even want to live. I'm so burned out on people not cooperating, on people not sticking with you, and let's not pulling together, people settling for less than what we could do for the Lord. And if that's you, God is saying to you, like he did to Elijah, okay, rest a little bit, get something to eat, take a walk, and listen. I'm not done, and you're not alone. I'm with you, and there are a bunch of other people who support you. There are a lot of other people who I'm going to raise up to work with you. If you've lost all your friends right now, there are a bunch of people out there who would love to be your friend. And that's the message that he wants to whisper to you if you're discouraged today. But either way, we shoot for the temple. Sometimes we get Elijah in a cave. But what do? We listen to the voice of the Lord and we continue to commit ourselves to do our best for him in everything that we do. But we get up and we keep moving and we look for people who are like-minded to work with and we see what we can accomplish despite the fact that it's not perfect and it is difficult and there are challenges, but you're not alone. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you for those temple experiences. It's amazing when things come together and people are attentive to detail and are devoted to doing things as unto you, and we love that. And that's what we want our whole life to be like, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes we're Elijah in a cave where it's not working the way we thought it would. God, in either way, we need to look forward to what you're going to do. We can't rest on our laurels, celebrate the past, and forget the future. But we also can't afford to be defeated because not everyone cares about quality and not everyone puts 100% effort into serving you and doing things as unto you. And sometimes people will reject us. So Lord, if that's where we're at, whisper to us your words of encouragement, your words of promise, the plans that you have for us in the future, and help us to continue to move forward doing things with your wisdom, with your beauty, with your creativity, with your love. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand. If you're here today and you've never really come into a relationship with Jesus Christ, your life's in a heap, but he wants to whisper to you today that he's not done with you yet. Your life can start over today. You get a mulligan right now by coming to him and saying, I want you to forgive my sins and give me a fresh start. If that's what you need, if you've never been a part of anything that's worked and you're really discouraged and he's whispering to you right now, come to me. Come to me. I'll forgive your sins. I died for you. If that's you, then come on down afterwards and get some prayer. If you need prayer for any reason, come on down. People would love to pray with you. But this week, let's listen for the whispers of God and let's move forward. And whatever we do this week, let's not do it cheesy. Let's do it the best that we can because that's the kind of God that we serve. And let's honor him with how we do what we do. And if it's been frustrating, keep moving. You're not as alone as you think you are. God bless.